This talk's actually going to be in two parts. The very first part of this will be more about the currents and the significance of these mineral precipitates, and there's a range of them that I'm going to talk about, but I'll be mainly talking about the acid pH range. End part of the talk will be more about the... And Mark Raven will be talking more about the actual mineralogy, X-ray identification, and some of the synthesis. So effectively, what I'm going to talk about is an introduction as to what are acid sulfate soils, what are these saltifluorescences that are really good mineral indicators of the environment, and the mineral transformations that are taking place mainly as a consequence of evaporation due to drought in very shallow waters in the Murray-Darling Basin system in Australia, and I'll show you where that is now. And I'm actually going to talk a little bit more about a range of these environments, but I'm going to concentrate more on these lower lake systems at the lower part of the Murray-Darling Basin, very, very similar to what Chris talked about in his talk in these very shallow lakes, and some of the tributaries. And then I'm going to talk about the Murray River itself as to where these precipitates are forming, and to show that it's not just localised in terms of these inland systems, but occurs along the coast and in parts of Victoria. So where is the system? This is where I come from here, Adelaide and in South Australia. This is, in fact, the driest state just outside Antarctica, really. So it's pretty dry. And if you have a drought, which you've just gone through, the most severe drought in living memory, which is the cause of a lot of what I'm going to talk about. And this is the Murray-Darling Basin. This is the system here, which is massive, really. And the rivers that flow here all flow down into these lake systems down here. And these are fairly large lakes. For example, this is about 60, 70 kilometres long, about 30 kilometres wide. And there are actually two lakes. There's Lake Alexandrina and Lake Albert. And what I'm going to talk mostly about is a drought that occurred. It started in about 2006 and just continued and continued, and it's just broken recently with floods. But during that time period, these rivers started drying up in all the wetlands, and these two lakes down here started drying up very much like the Aral Sea, really. And it's what I'm going to talk about is the salt efflorescences and the soils that have actually formed in these systems as a consequence of this draining. So really, I'm going to give a very brief introduction as to what are acid sulfate soils and pyrite oxidation. Effectively, acid sulfate soils, we call them acid sulfate soils, are actually soils that contain pyrite. And if that pyrite oxidizes, when you get oxidation, you end up with effectively sulfuric acid and a lot of saltifluorescences, and in many instances, minerals that can actually store acidity. And in this instance, the inland occurrences that we find in Australia are mainly that of natriajarosite rather than jarosite, because of the high sodium contents in the system. And we're going to talk a lot about these hydrated oxysulfate minerals that are formed. And these are what these minerals look like. They've actually formed in many instances at pHs very low, in fact below 3.5, or in some instances below 2.5, very acid conditions. But I have to say there are also saltifluorescences that I'll talk about at the end of the talk that occur at the higher pHs, and that would be more the thenodites, these sorts of minerals that do occur at the higher pHs. But these mineral efflorescences are very good indicators of what's going on. Now, just as background, I'm not going to talk a lot about it, but in terms of these acid sulfate soil characterisations, we do a lot of tests to prove that, in fact, there's pyrite in the system. And we do field tests using peroxide testing, so we can test these occurrences of pyrite on the spot. We do detailed acid-base accounting, so we do the full chemistry to determine how much pyrite's there, how much stored acidity is there, and so on. And we use the soil taxonomy incubation aging test, in other words, let the soil speak for itself, so to speak, use the pun, and we actually have developed a technique where we actually age these in chip trays that we collect in the field and let these actually age and measure their pHs with time under rated conditions. Now, to make it even a little bit more confusing, in Australia, we've decided that the sulfidic material that is used in soil taxonomy is a bit restrictive. So we've invented, in effect, two other terms to, in fact, describe sulfidic material in a bit more detail. So we've come up with a term called hypersulfidic, which is equivalent, really, to soil taxonomy's sulfidic as it is now, and a term hyposulfidic that would indicate soils that have got sulfide in but don't oxidise to below 4 or 3.5. So the term in Australia now for sulfidic is effectively an adjective just to indicate soils that have actually got sulfides in them. So if we talk about a sulfidic soil, it just means that there's some sulfide in there. But if we talk about a hypersulfidic soil, it means it's got sulfide in, it's going to, when it oxidizes, it will reduce below 3.5. In Australia, we use pH 4. The other terminologies are quite sulfuric material in Australia is equivalent to the sulfuric horizon, in other words, 4 or below pH 3.5. We've also ended up in Australia having a term called monosulfidic material, which just means soils that have got AVS higher than 0.5, in other words, where you've got greigite and acoenoite minerals in them. In other words, the monosulfides. So to summarise that, really, a hypersulfidic material would be these black sulfide-containing soils. And, of course, here's an example of the hypersulfidic material or sulfidic material. It's black, containing sulfide, and when this oxidises, you'd get the normal natrogerasite examples. In this instance, it would be more natrogerasite here as mottles. And very often, in the surfaces of these areas that have dried out as a consequence of drought conditions, we'd either find schwetmanite, this orange-coloured mineral here, where the pH would be around about pH 4 to 3.5 to 4. But in many instances, I'm going to talk about pHs that are much lower. We've also developed a more easy terminology, if you like, to bring out the subaqueous materials and a terminology that we can just talk about a soil as being sulfuric soil, would mean containing sulfuric material or sulfuric horizon. And we use this terminology more to annotate diagrams, as I'll show you now, or if it's got sulfidic material, hyper or hyposulfidic material. And of course, acid sulfates are important because of their acidification. And of course, they can acidify water bodies when water reflows back into these dried systems that contain sulfuric material or sulfuric horizons. These monosulfidic materials can actually smell because they've got these monosulfides in and pollute waters. And many of these areas have got quite high trace metal contents. Surprisingly, a lot of selenium. We don't find a lot of selenium in our systems, but more arsenic, loads of aluminium, and of course it does have an impact on the biodiversity. So to get to the sort of main ball game, what I'm going to talk about is this Murray-Darling Basin system in Australia, which is up in this region here. Effectively, in the 1920s, they decided that they really wanted to look like the Mississippi. So that make it look like the Mississippi, they decided to put a lot of locks in there, put in barrages to get the waters to continue to maintain the system so they can navigate. So in the 1920s, they just built all these systems to maintain fresh water in the system, and they put in something like about 8 locks to maintain these waters. Now that was great when we have lots of water, and for the last 80 to 100 years, quite a lot of water. We've had little bits of drought, but by and large, this system has been relatively full of water. And while it's been full of water, we've made, just like the previous, like Chris has indicated, we've manufactured sulfides in the lakes, lower lakes, and of course in here, and they've accumulated. So we've accumulated as a consequence of irrigation, as a consequence of time, whereas previously this Murray-Darling Basin system would wet and dry, burn a lot of the sulfide up. What's happened is because of all this manufactured by putting in barrages and locks and things, we've actually accumulated masses of amount of pyrite in these lower lakes and in these systems. But since 2006, we've had a drought, and that drought has effectively caused these bottom sediments or these lake systems to become exposed. And this little graph here shows you Lake Alexandrina for the last, if you like, 80 years. It's been full of water. This is the lake level here. And from about 2006, it's just, we've had a drought and of course no water, and these whole systems have started evaporating, a bit like the Aral Sea. And of course the salinities have increased in these lakes, and this is the sort of air photo showing, this is the Coorong, and this is Lake Alexandrina, and all these sediments have basically been exposed. So to give you some idea as to what this looks like, I'll take you through a series of slides to give you an idea of this impact of pre-drought and drought formation of acid sulfate soils. I'll sort of summarise what I've just been talking about. The pre-drought condition, in other words, for the last 80 years, basically has generated soils that have been benign, plenty of fish, fantastic environment to live in, not a problem. But during drought conditions, we actually end up with what is David Dent has called the most nastiest soils in the world have in fact formed. So we've gone from soils that are basically benign, protected underwater, full of pyrite. When these drain, we end up with the nastiest. And here's a good example of what's actually happened. In August 2007, we suspected that in fact the drought continued, that we would have a problem. And we had the great privilege of getting some funding to start sampling these water systems when they were full of water. So in August 2007, the drought had already started impacting and these rivers were draining. This is the tributary of one of the Lake Alexandrina. And this here, these are two little boys fishing. While we were sampling off the end of this jetty, they in fact caught two fish. And you could really call this system benign, and you could see from this the pH of this water and the system was 8.4. And it had been like that for the past 80 years. Went back to that same very site in November 2008, exactly the same area, and you can see it's starting to dry out. These sediments or soils underneath here, these subaqueous soils here, are black, exposing the peritic sediments. Salt, what we'll actually call these are hypersulfitic materials. This is hypersulfitic material. This would be subaqueous. This is this sulfitic material being exposed. When we went back and sampled this 18 months later from here, that's exactly the same area. You can see the salt efflorescences, and we end up with effectively the nastiest soils in the world, sulfuric material. And in this instance, the pHs on the edge of these systems have pHs between 0.5 to 3.5. And exposing, after 18 months, sulfuric acid formation, massive amount of available aluminium, iron, magnesium sulfate minerals, and of course a pH of 3.5. And we don't trust the pH meter. We've actually got kits that can actually measure down to these low pHs to show that these sulfur fluorescences, particularly these ones here, which I'll explain a little bit about just now, the sidronitrite, occur at below pHs 2.5. And you can see these are the pHs here. So to summarize, this is the benign hypersulfitic material. This is it being exposed. And here's the actual low pHs. And these are the sorts of minerals that are actually found in the system. Epsomite, large amounts of magnesium sulfate minerals, hexahydrite, gypsum, tamarugite, which is the aluminium sulfate hydroxy salt, alunogen in quite high amounts. So you can see the system is pretty rich in aluminium. The greenish salt crystals, some of it being the magnesium copiapites, lanterite, but by far the most dominant one, to our surprise, was this yellowish salt mineral called sidronatrite, which is a sodium iron sulfate mineral. And Mark Raven in the next talk will explain a lot about this mineral and how to identify it and how to synthesize it and compare it with the system. Now, what we could do, we could actually describe these systems mainly to the community groups, to the managers that manage these water systems, the problem that we have, and we could explain how they form. So basically this here just explains that when these barrages were put in the 30s to make it look like the Mississippi River, fill it up with water, and the pHs were 8.4 when we sampled it. As it drained out, you can see these edge systems drain out. A little bit of water left in the middle, as you can see in this slide here. When the drought really hit, cattle walked in here to try and get water, plugged these systems, and you can see I've described here these sulfur fluorescences. I've used a little symbol, and a lot of those salts would be the sidronatrite and these other sodium sulfate salts that are forming at these very low pHs. And of course, you can see the soil cracks. And of course, in some instances where the pHs are slightly higher, schwepanite minerals would be interdispersed with these systems. And this is just repeats the same story, but in some of the wetlands that are adjoining these areas that are even more acid. pH is down mostly in the 0.5 ranges. Now, this is a dried wetland here, showing these low pHs of 1.5 to 4. And we predicted, explaining to the water people, that if we had a flood, or if it started raining, the water would flow in here and we would get acid conditions. And that's what happened. We had a slight wet period. In May 2009, the waters came in and the waters were ranging at pH 3.3. So these were these acid waters in the system, and showing some of these. When the waters came in, some of the more sandy areas contained a lot of these sidronatrite minerals. But Mark's going to talk more about this. This is just an example of what it looked like when the waters came in, precipitating on the edges. That's what it looks like. That's what the stuff looks like. This is what happened when it actually, when the waters came in and were actually flowing at pHs. Here's an example of these cracks. And you can see this is where the water came in. And you can actually see aluminium flocks surrounding these areas. This is just the dissolution of the alunogen, the aluminium sulfate salt minerals. And when we auger down into these systems, we find that the jarosite minerals are still retained. So although waters have come in, the soils below these systems are still very, very acid. And in some instances where you've got this mineral sidronatrite on the edges, when we had reflooding, we found that some of the pools contained large amounts of schwepanite, indicating to us that when these systems mixed with water, the sidronatrite was in fact converting or transforming to schwepanite. And Mark will talk a lot about that in his talk, where he's actually synthesized these to prove that sort of process. This is just showing a slightly different environment where we actually first identified sidronatrite way back in 1998, and we thought it was a bit of a unique mineral and weren't too concerned, but this is in the Mount Lofty Ranges in the hills, where we had some of these streams that were cut, and we found sidronatrite and tamarugite actually on the edges of eroded streams, and we saw precipitates of aluminium gels and some of the schwetmanite in places in the adjoining areas. And that was only for one season, and here's some more examples of it that Mark will talk about, and of course the precipitates of schwetmanite very close to where we find the sidronatrite minerals. So really what we could do by understanding the system, we could work out, if you like, a conceptual model showing what it looked like in a subaqueous situation with evaporation, how these salt efflorescences form, how the soils formed, and what happens when they actually re-wet. Now, that was a little system that we looked at up here in the upland waters of the system. I'm going to just talk and give you some idea of what's actually happening around the lake and around that Lake Albert. And it's a very similar story, but just to give you some idea of the magnitude of what we're looking at. Now, as I explained earlier, these lake systems are very shallow. Very shallow. The average about Lake Albert, which is this one here, averages about 2 meters. Lake Alexandrina is slightly deeper, about 3 meters. And from the bathymetry, we could work out that if it kept on evaporating and drought conditions occur, what would be exposed at a certain time? And we knew from all the net acidity values, because we did a soil survey of these lake systems that were when they were still underwater, so we had a very good idea. And this is an example here of what these areas look like after being exposed. Something like 20,000 hectares of sulfuric material formed in a period of 18 months. The largest area, we believe, in the world to have actually been exposed. And when we flew over these areas, we could see these patterns of bright yellow and orange patterns and in these areas here that had been exposed. So we could, in fact, develop a model to show what would happen if, in fact, the drought continued. So we could say, well, this is when we had the lakes full of water at a period when it was about minus 0.5 metres below sea level. This is 1 metre that these areas would be exposed to form sulfuric material. And this is what these areas look like close up. These are exposed beaches showing these strange colour patterns. This is what the sidronatrite actually looks like. And I'll just be showing you more photographs around the lake of what the system looks like. So these are these salt efflorescences. They form almost like a crust. And when it rains, they dissolve and form these orange patches. This is an orange patch or reddish-brown patch. That's the sidronatrite. And in some of the other areas, we could, as I did before, show you cross-sections of where the sulfidic material occurs, the jarosites, and then the salt efflorescences that occur in some of the adjacent systems. Again, just another example in some of these transects, in some of the areas, again showing sidronatrite salt efflorescences, the schwetmanite salt efflorescences that occur more at a slightly higher pH. And this is a cross-section, again, to emphasise that pyrite accumulation in these lake systems occurred over an 80-year period. When the drought struck, they were exposed and formed these sidronatrite minerals as a consequence of oxidation of pyrite to form these two systems. And we did quite a bit of electron microscopy to show what the sidronatrite looks like. And this is an example of sidronatrite, even a close-up of the pyrite. We believe this actually is the mechanisms that have formed. Mark will prove that more in his synthesis experiments in the next talk. This is Lake Albert, just to show another example of what Lake Albert looked like in 2007. And this is an example of that exact place out in the lake in 2009. It's completely dry. You can see that's that exact same photograph. And this is after a bit of re-wetting later on. Again, very similar. We've got done a lot of pedology in these areas to show that the exposure of the different sediments, what they look like, and what happens when these areas re-wet. Now, what they try to do in these systems, because they knew it was going to drain, the whole lake would have drained, they decided to pump water from the one lake to the other to maintain the water levels. So they actually pumped water and built levee banks costing millions of dollars to maintain the water levels to prevent the whole area from actually developing sulfuric material. Just a quick slide to show that a lot of other minerals that we did identify. Redingtonite, which is a bit strange, contains a bit of nickel, botrygen, a lot of magnesium sulfate salts in the system. And just some more photographs, really, as to when the waters came in, you actually had masses of, if you like, precipitates in these waters of schwefelite, orange waters as the waters came in. And you can see some of these waters here, these orange waters. Massive areas of 200-300 hectares of acid waters exposed when the waters came in. Quite spectacular, really, of what they looked like. And again, we developed models to show what was happening when they were full of water, what happens when they drain, and what happens when they re-wet, to explain to the water authorities as to what's happening. This is a photograph of sidronatrite in Victoria, which is something like about 500 kilometres away from the Lower Lakes, that it's not just unique to the Lower Lake system. This is a coastal system where we found tamarugite, which is the aluminium one, and sidronatrite as well. So that's more in the coastal systems. And as a sort of summary slide, to show that these different pHs produce a range of these salt efflorescences. So effectively, below pH 2.5, we end up with these tamarugite, sidronatrite minerals. pH 3.5, more the jarosite, natrojarosites, or plumber jarosite we've identified in some of our hill samples. 4 to 4.5, schwetmanite, very occasionally akaganiite we've identified. Lepidocrosite occurring between the 5 to 6.5, and above that, ferrihydrite. So they are very, very good mineral indicators of what's going on. Now, sidronatrite, which is the new one that we've identified, tends to form more in sandy alluvium systems. Stream bank areas where you get seems to be quite a high rate of oxidation, very low pHs, poor buffering environments, which is invariably in sandy materials, and obviously you need the geochemistry there, high iron, sulfate, and sodium environments in the pore waters. And we're proposing that the sidronatrite and schwetmanite should become a mineral indicator for soil taxonomy and other systems, because they are really good mineral indicators. And particularly the sidronatrite, schwetmanite is being used more as a mineral indicator. But we're proposing now that sidronatrite, simply because we have identified it in several other places, should be considered at least as a good mineral indicator. Mark Raven and I had the privilege of actually meeting Satori, who's spent most of his life studying the mineral structure of sidronatrite. We met him last year in Bari after the International Clay Minerals meeting. And this is him and his co-worker. He's now retired, but he's done a lot of work just studying. I'm going to end off by just talking about one last area, which is the high pH end. And this is now in the Murray River. This is right down the lower areas. And I'll just show you a transect through one of these wetlands, a wetland called Jury Swamp. And this is that cross-section through that area showing, effectively, this is the Murray River itself. So this scale's been exaggerated. It shows all the pyrite sediments in here, sulfidic material or hypersulfidic material. These are the areas that have actually drained. Some of these areas are acid, and some of these areas are reasonably alkaline. Now, here's an area in one of these wetlands that actually contains halite, bludite, which is the sodium magnesium sulfate mineral, cunneyite, sodium magnesium sulfate mineral, lowiite, which is a sodium magnesium sulfate mineral, schermingite, which is an ammonium aluminium sulfate mineral. Now, this area happens to be polluted from an adjacent area that gets a lot of the cattle walking on it. So these indicators are telling us that this is pretty probably polluted from ammonium. But what's important here is that this, when we sampled this area, it was in the middle of summer, it was 40 degrees centigrade plus for a week, and these are quite good mineral indicators of not only the geochemistry of this environment and the acidity, but also high temperatures, and Mark will talk a little bit about this, these experiments that he's done as well. So effectively, to conclude, these acid sulfate soils themselves are very, very good indicators of land degradation, water quality, and of course, I didn't talk much about it, but human and animal health in these systems, because basically, a lot of these systems, you can see from the fish deaths, there's a lot of sheep and cattle deaths around these areas because of the high magnesium areas and licks in the soils and also from the waters. And they can indicate or predict these drying conditions. And of course, we've been able to use these mechanistic models to show where these mineral precipitates occur. And of course, this can be linked to management options. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Why we're proposing sidronatrite now as a good mineral indicator is that the areas of the lakes that were exposed at that period of time was, we know, 20,000 hectares, which is huge. And of that area, 90% of it would have had sidronatrite interdispersed in those soils. Together with, if you did have some rain, some schwepanite. And even at lower depths, we were finding sidronatrite. So it's on a quite large scale. So when we first identified it, way back in 1995, it occurred in one location only. We thought it was a unique little mineral, didn't pay much attention. But we've now found it up the River Murray. We've also found it, and Mark will be talking about it in his talk, in the arid zone, so we found it exposed in quite large areas, albeit little seeps in the arid zone as well. And it seems to be quite stable in the sense that, if you add water, it can be dissolved, but we believe even that in itself is a good mineral indication of what's going on in the system. No, it occurs in Victoria in the north and in central Australia. So it occurs very widespread, and we found it in one location in the wheat belt of Western Australia as well, sidronatrite.
Has there been any work on dust emissions from the salt?
Oh, geez, you know, I left part of this little talk out because I thought I wouldn't fit it in. And it was all about dust emission. That was the last little bit, and Mark persuaded me to leave it out because we're not too sure about it. But Brenda, I'll show you that. But yes, we've done some work on in fact, it's quite an interesting experiment because what happened was that the dust emission blew on galvanized iron roofs, dissolved the roofs, and we've done a lot of mineralogy work on the new minerals that are formed with zinc on those roofs. So, yep. Right. Okay, I'll answer that question. we're in a unique situation that we've just had floods. So that whole area is now flooded. And we've just been given money to revisit those exact sites, and we've got 50 of them around those lakes that were exposed, and they're now monitoring sites that we're going to monitor for the next 5 years. Now, two of them we've monitored already that have been underwater, and what we've found is that the sidronatrite and the schwertmannite have reconverted to greigite, macowiniite, so the monosulfides, but only in the top 2 to 3 centimetres. Below that, all the jarosite, natrojarosite, down to a metre are still intact because basically they've closed in, at water, these things have cracked and the jarosites are still there. Now, we're going to be following that over the next 4 years to see how long it takes for diffusion to come down and rehabilitate those areas. But the thing is, though, if we have another drought, we've already used up all the alkalinity in a lot of those bottom sediments, so we're going to get even greater amounts of sidronatrite formed when this becomes exposed in the next drought.
Sorry, is smectite involved in the crack formation?
Yes, in some instances where the clay areas, and we've mapped the clay areas, yes, smectite is the dominant mineral, and of course that's where a lot of the aluminium precipitates are actually coming from.